This is Content Content, a monthly podcast featuring technical communicators and web content professionals. Hi, I'm Ed Marsh. This is episode number one, recorded January 24th, 2015. Thanks for joining us on our maiden voyage. My guest today is Sharon Burton, a technical communication and content strategy consultant. You can find all things Sharon at sharonburton.com. I first met Sharon through Twitter back in 2009 when she was working for Madcap Software, the makers of the Flare Help authoring tool. We finally met in person at LavaCon 2013, and it was like meeting an old friend, which is why I'm delighted to have her as my first guest. Sharon is an adjunct professor at the University of California, Riverside, teaching technical communications to engineering majors and postgraduates. She's also an associate fellow of the Society for Technical Communication. Sharon is very prolific on Twitter, at Sharon Burton, and I look forward every morning to see how the weather is in California. So how's the weather today in Southern California, Sharon?
I'm compelled by state law to tell you that it's actually quite lovely. It's about 65 degrees. We're expecting about 80 today, and I know you're under about 6 inches of snow, and I know it's mean for me to say this, but state law requires if they find out that I didn't say that, then I get a fine.
All right, noted. For the record, California is beautiful and Jersey is snowy. So Sharon, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and your background in technical communication and content strategy?
Oh my gosh, I'm always the least interesting person in the room, I think. One of the things that, I just told this story the other day, so I'm going to tell it again because it's fun. I got into this field accidentally. I grew up with a mother who would pull out product instructions when they, you know, my parents brought a new product, and my mother would read them and then shake their head and then shake them at us kids, and say, "And somebody got paid money for this. Can you believe that?" that was all I knew about product instructions. But I was a graduate student in cultural anthropology. I was getting my PhD, and I knew a bunch of guys over in Comp Sci, because they were the building right across from the anthropology building, and one of my professors was very interested in computers. And so there was a lot of interaction back and forth between the two departments. And I was really interested in computers and what they did and how they thought about it. And one of the guys I knew called me one day and said, "Hey, you know, I'm working for this small company a couple of towns over, and we're looking for somebody to write the product manuals for our products. Is that something you'd be interested in?" And I said, "God, I can't think of anything more boring. What does it pay?" And he said, "Well, it pays $10 an hour." And I said, "You know, I think I'd love to do that. I think that sounds fabulous." And I thought, well, you know, I'll do this until I get bored, you know, and then I'll go on and do something for real with my life, because, you know, this is $10 an hour, and it's, at the time, it was huge amounts of money. And I'm not bored yet. I'm just
funny
not.
How that works out.
Yeah, you know, and for the record, when I told my mother what I was doing, she sighed. I said, "No, really, Mom, it's really interesting." And she just shook her head and looked at me like I'd lost my mind.
You're the someone who gets paid to write these things.
You know, yeah, I'm the one who gets, and someone got paid to write this. Yeah, Ma, that would be me. So that's how I got into this field. And I find this field endlessly interesting. There's always something new and different and exciting. And I think the power of what we do is remarkable. I had this epiphany about 10 years ago that what we do is potentially one of the most important things one can do. Because what we do is we provide information so that humans can do stuff. And that sounds, on the face of it, it sounds very simple and trivial, and it's like, right, whatever. You know, I mean, we're not, you know, cracking somebody's chest open and fixing their heart, right? Except that one of the things that I know about humans is we are an enormously creative group. And if you give us information, we'll go and do crazy and wackadoodle things like solve HIV or send skateboards to Mars or I don't know what, you know? And that's the part that excites me. I don't even know what. People who are way smarter than I am will take that information and go do things that never occurred to me would be a thing to do. And that's what we do. We provide that information. I can't think of anything more exciting to do. I really can't.
That's amazing.
And it makes a difference, you know? And it might be something as silly here with air quotes, silly and inconsequential. Maybe you write policies and procedures for a living. But maybe because you wrote a really good policy and procedure, somebody who's going through some horrible event in their life can easily apply for like long-term leave or something. You know, I don't know what it is, but everybody in our field does something that is making life easier or inspiring people or something. I think this is an amazing, amazing field. I just think it's, I get excited and I'm waving my arms. That's just me. I wave my arms when I get excited, and I think this field is tremendously exciting.
Well, it's great to see your passion. Do you have a specific passion recently in TechCom or content strategy?
The last maybe 18 months or so, I've been really interested in the intersection between customer experience and product instructions. I've spent my career focused on product instructions. I've tried policies and procedures, and I'm not very good at it, and I find it kind of boring. And okay. There are people who are very, very good at that, and they should do that. You know, we should all do that piece that we find exciting. I don't find policies and procedures exciting. I like product instructions a lot. And one of the things that customer experience, which is a field, believe it or not, they're looking at what is it that we need to do as a company to make every experience a customer has with us compelling and interesting and good, because at this point, for most companies, that's the competitive advantage. Most products now are commodities in that there are several people making that product, everybody has features, and you know that. Think about the TechCom vendors. You know, pretty much to a great extent, all of the TechCom tools do the same thing, and everybody's got features, and yay for them. You know, it's just one of those things. So yeah, you got features, yay. Yeah, your competitors, they got features too. But people want to do business with companies that seem to like doing business with them. And customer experience is very focused on that. And when I started looking at customer experience as a field, I realized that they're spending a great deal of time with the experience right up until you purchase a product. And then the next part, the post-sales part that they care about is customer support. They're very interested in customer support. They want to make sure that customer support is pleasant to deal with and knowledgeable and all of that stuff. And I looked at that and I thought, wait, hang on, we're missing a big part between the sale and customer support, and that's product instructions. Because in my experience and in the limited research I've done, people don't typically go from, I can't figure out how to do this in the product, to, I'll call support. Most people want to solve their own problem. So they go to the product instructions, or they do a search in the knowledge base, if the knowledge base is available. Or they try means to help themselves before they call customer support. And none of us wake up in the morning and go, you know what? I get to call customer support today. I'm so happy. This is the best. Let me get coffee, maybe like a muffin, you know, because this is going to be so much fun, right? People want to get on with their lives. And calling customer support is disruptive. I don't disagree that customer experience should be focused on that, But there's this piece, and that's the piece that we do that is between good you bought the product and how can I help you? And that's where I'm really interested in that piece now. I don't think that product instructions are the compelling reason why you would buy more product, but I think in an invisible way it goes to ease of use of the product. And that makes you perhaps even unconsciously more interested in buying more of the product because thus far it was easy to use and it was pleasant and I'm just going on and on, aren't I?
No, it's a great perspective. So do you think, I mean, we're going from a world of manuals to product instructions. Who's doing it good and who's not doing it not so well?
Who's doing it good? That's one of those things, isn't it? I'm trying to think in my everyday experience who's doing it well. Not in my professional experience, but my everyday experience. And I have to tell you, you know who's doing it well? Printer manufacturers. They're doing it well. They figured out quite some time ago that they could reduce product returns and customer support calls by doing simple, clear, easy setup instructions. And so you saw, and everybody does it now, you see when you buy a printer, you open the box, and that's called the out-of-the-box experience, something customers, experience professionals really look at. You open the box, and before you do anything, you get a nice, big, shiny thing with lots of color that shows you how to set up your printer. Now, they also, printer manufacturers, have put a lot of thought into making setting up printers as much plug and play as you can possibly make it. So it's both sides. It's not just the instructions. But the instructions look like, oh, this is easy. Apple does the same thing. There are good, compelling reasons why my mobile ecosystem is all Apple. And we own now in my house two iPhones and two iPads. And the out-of-box experience with them is brilliant. You open the package, it looks elegant, but it doesn't look so elegant that it looks scary. You know, it just looks elegant like, oh, this is nice. You know, somebody put some thought into this. And then right out of the box, you're able to just easily start using the device. My husband is a technophobe. He's a wonderful man for many reasons, but he doesn't like technology at all. It upsets him, which I think is hysterical considering he married me. But when I got him both his iPhone and his iPad, I watched him because he doesn't like technology. It upsets him. Right. But yet he felt confident that he could get started and adequately use these products. There's a Dutch guy who, it's on my website, he did some research into how Americans, I don't know why this Dutch guy did Americans, but he did, maybe because there's a lot of us, I don't know. What is it that we do when we buy a product? And he found out that for consumer products at least, we spend about 20 minutes with a product, and at the end of that 20 minutes, we've made a decision that we can use the product or we can't. And if we can't use it, we return it. And I think that 20 minutes is not spent mastering the product, that out-of-the-box experience. You're not spending 20 minutes mastering the product. You're spending 20 minutes doing an evaluation that you feel confident, that you can feel confident you can use it. So it's feeling thing. And I think TechPubs really has the possibility of impacting that 20 minutes. So that's where things like quick starts and getting started guides and those kinds of really job aids come up. And that well-designed ones make people feel confident that they can feel confident they can use it. And if they don't, they return it. And that goes directly to the bottom line, directly.
That's great stuff. I actually had a not-so-good customer experience recently. There was a wireless provider that was giving away, or not giving away, but they had basically offering Wi-Fi hotspots for $5 a month. And it was in all the tech news, and I got excited, and I went to their site and said, oh, you have availability, let's sign up. And then there was no mention of where this information was, how to get to the hotspots. They asked me to download an app that didn't mention any hotspots. It mentioned telephone and messaging, but nothing about Wi-Fi. There's absolutely nothing on their website, and you keep going around in circles, and it was a horrible experience. And now I don't want to use their product, and I want to install the app as soon as possible. And they've most likely lost my business, even though it was something that I was willing to pay for.
And think about that. They've priced their product very attractively, so they have to make up whatever profit they're going to make. They have to do it on volume. That's the only way their business model is going to work, is if they get 10,000 million people to sign up for $5 a month, right? Except they blew the part where you actually then use the product. So they're probably seeing an enormous number of people running out the back door. Yeah, you signed up and then you leave. Have you seen, there's a video, I was thinking about this last night, I need to look it up. There's a video I saw that I just thought was just the most brilliant video ever. These people somewhere, I assume somewhere in China because they're pandas, they've got baby pandas in a playpen. And these people are doing work. I assume they're some sort of biologist taking care of pandas. And so they're doing work around the panda playpen. And the pandas are being pandas. And so every time somebody turns their back, all the baby pandas are doing are trying to get out of the playpen. And so these people are doing work around, and then every time somebody turns around, they have to put a panda back in the playpen. And I was thinking that's the most perfect metaphor for screwing up the customer experience. Sure, you got the customers in the playpen, except that they're constantly trying to get out because it's not fun in the playpen. It's not happening. And so you jumped out of the playpen, and they could probably give you the service for free at this point, and you're just frustrated and you don't want to be part of it.
Right. And there was a mention of it on their blog. There wasn't anything in their FAQs or their knowledge base. Their forum didn't have anything about it. And maybe it's because it was a new product and they just launched it. But I would have thought that if you're going to announce something this big and potentially this popular, they would have put more thought into the content behind it.
Well, you know, I've got a blog post that's enormously popular that kind of goes to this, which is neither your products nor your product instructions are Jimmy Buffett. I'm a big Parrothead fan. I love Jimmy Buffett, big Parrothead. And companies act as though they're Jimmy Buffett. I don't know if you've ever tried to get Jimmy Buffett tickets, but, you know, what happens is word gets out that Jimmy Buffett is going on tour. Everybody, you know, tickets are going to be released through Ticketron or whatever it is, and starting at, say, 10 o'clock in the morning. And half of the state is sitting in front of their computer at 9:45, hitting refresh, hitting refresh, hitting refresh, hitting refresh, hitting refresh, hitting refresh. And then the instant those tickets go on sale, you better grab whatever it is that Ticketron or Ticketmaster, whoever it is, says is available, because if you waste even 3 minutes, that show is going to sell out. 10,000 seats, 10,000 seats sell out in 3 minutes. You're never going to have an audience like that. It's never going to happen. People are not ever going to do that for your products. So it's up to you or us or whoever it is. We have to make it easy for our customers to use our products. And I think that's where the product instructions come in. Obviously, this company thought you would be so excited about their product that you would jump through hoops.
And pay a convenience fee.
And a convenience fee. And, you know, drink margaritas in their parking lot. And, you know, dance with 10,000 of your closest friends. It's just not going to happen. So, it makes me so frustrated. It's so dumb. People get all, it's that if you build it, they will come thing. You know, well, we're really excited about it, so obviously the whole world is. No, the whole world's not. They're not that excited about you. You're not that exciting. You're just not.
Especially when there's 100 other companies doing the same thing on the web now.
See, and that's why customer experience has really captured my interest for the last bit. because there are 20 companies out there doing probably exactly what you're doing. What's the compelling reason to do business with you over the competition? It's not features. It's probably not even price. It's, is it easy to do business with you? Is it pleasant? Do you want to come back? That's the compelling thing. And that's, I think, what's going to make a company go from, eh, to successful. That's the compelling difference. I could go on about this for hours, apparently, I just realized, and I'm probably boring everybody to death now at this point.
I've been doing this for 20 years now, and, you know, to hear your passion and your excitement and your level and to relate with the stories, especially of buying tickets or, you know, dealing with a major internet service provider who wants to merge with another major internet service provider. It's just, you know, everyone has these frustrations, and I think you're right that the difference is how easy are you going to make the experience when something goes wrong or when you get by something right out of the box. And we've all had the bad experiences, and I think they greatly outweigh the positive experiences.
Life is, for most of us, complicated. You know, we've got jobs, we've got, you know, children or family obligations, there's running households, there's, you know, all of that stuff. And products that are designed to fit into that easily have to do better than products that are that thought isn't given to. And any product, I watch my husband with his iPhone. This guy who doesn't like technology, doesn't trust it, in 15 minutes had mastered getting around his iPhone. He still occasionally asks me, how do I do X? But by and large, in 15 minutes, he was up, he was running, he was functional. The phone is, in essence, transparent in his life. And he's comfortable with it. Yay, because the last four phones he wasn't comfortable with, and he never liked them, and all he did was complain about them. So yay, he doesn't complain about this.
Now I guess I have to ask, did he use the product instructions when he got his phone?
He actually did, and I, in part because he's a journalist, and in part because he's married to somebody who spends so much time talking about product instructions, he did actually read them, but not until, and it was very interesting, he fiddled with the phone, and I think that's part of that Dutch researcher's, you know, 20 minutes. He fiddled with the phone for a bit, and I think then he felt confident he could use it, and then he read the instructions. And I thought that was a really interesting approach, and I don't think it's an unusual approach.
So do you think that there'll have come a point where products are so intuitive that we won't need instructions anymore, or even a quick start guide? I mean, phones, everything, the manuals are getting thinner and thinner. Is there a point where everything's so intuitive that we won't even need them any longer?
Yes and no. I think for ubiquitous everyday technology, no, we don't need instructions. Do you need an instruction to use a toaster? I mean, seriously. You know, at this point, toaster. You put some bread in, you push a button. Oh, that's too brown. Perhaps I should, you know, it's one of those things that unless you're coming in from a bush culture and have never seen electricity, it's just not that tough. And I think there is some technology that is, like phones, becoming ubiquitous. But I spend a lot of time in the business-to-business space, and the B2B space, not so much ubiquitous. There are things that everyday tasks should be very easy to do, but there are tasks, especially in business-to-business products, that you only do infrequently. End-of-year reporting, for example. You do that once a year. So who remembers from year to year? We've all looked at a product and gone, dang it, you know what, I've done this before, but I don't do it often, and I don't remember how to do it. For example, I'd like to take we have a DVD player in our home entertainment system, and the DVD player, you're going to laugh, the DVD player died about 8 years ago. I have no idea how this is all wired up, and I'm terrified of pulling it out of the system. Because I don't know how it's wired up, right? Because how often do you wire up that stuff?
Yeah, once.
Exactly. And, you know, we don't need to have it. I mean, everything works fine with it turned off, you know, all the time. But I look at that thing probably once a month and I think, God, I should pull that out. You know, I should just pull that out, put the Xbox up there, you know, and it'll all be fine. Because it bugs me to have this thing sitting there. It doesn't work. But then I think about, oh, I got to get back there. It's dark. It's dirty. It's dusty. I got to unwire things. I got to figure out how it's wired. No. It will just sit there until, I don't know, the whole system dies, and then I will pay someone to rewire it or something. I don't know. I don't wish to do that. And I think there are a lot of tasks in products that are like that. You do them very rarely. And I think that's where what we do really comes in. The ubiquitous, you know, I get real frustrated when I'm like on LinkedIn or Tech World or one of those discussion groups, and somebody, some tech comm professionals talking about something, and somebody chimes in with, oh no, I document everything because somebody might want to do it. And what that really means, I've discovered over the years, is, and I'm not saying all of us do this, I'm not, because all of us don't, but what that really means when you look at what they're documenting is they're documenting the obvious. In the file name field, type the file name. Really? Oh, thank God you told me that, because I was going to put my social security number in the file name field. And then, you know, put in my security question, where do I go to cry, you know, and then the answer would be my closet, right? Because in the file name field, type the file name, what value have we added? None. Zero. As a matter of fact, we have wasted our client or employer's time and money. We've wasted the reviewer's time, because some reviewer has to go, yep, yep, that would be exactly true. In the file name field, you would type the file name. Good, then, we've got that. Check that box. Right? Is there any human being at this point working with software who looks at the file name field and gets confused about what it is they're typing there? But yet, you look at another field where you're supposed to enter some sort of search parameter, right? And it's and you go to the help, you click on the little help button, and it says, enter standard search parameters. At that point, all you can do is scream. What standard search parameters? What are those? What are those? Someone tell, and then you crawl through the documentation, and it's not there. Why is it not there? Because the tech writer ran out of time because he or she spent all their time making sure that type the file name field in the file name is... I'm on a rant. But this drives me crazy. This is why you have... all of us, this is my thing for the entire field. Most people, when they start with, for example, a new software product, they look at that and they go, well, I don't know what to do with that. And so they're beginners, right? But even beginners know what to type in the file name field. And here's a clue. Clue. Most people very quickly transition from being a beginner to an intermediate user. Very few people move on to be an advanced user. Most people stay in the intermediate. And it's, all things being equal, it's a bell curve, which means 66% of your users, one standard deviation, are in the intermediate users. Which means if you've got to make decisions about what to cover, you can cover 2/3 of your users by documenting the intermediate user stuff. We don't document stuff because somebody might need it, right? Some mythical creature might not know what the file name field means, so we'll have to document that. No, no mythical creature. Nobody needs that documented.
No, I've done it. And it's like, you look at it and I think, you know, I think it's also the level of experience that people have now. You don't have many people who are coming out of college who have never touched a computer or have never typed a file name in the file name field. You know, it's almost.
Yeah.
Right.
So why are we wasting that time?
You're insulting their intelligence.
Exactly. And what you're doing is you're calling into question the veracity of all the other content that somebody has created. Because people look at, you know, they go to the help screen or they open the docs, whatever it is, however it is they get there. And they get a description of the file name field. They go, right, I knew that. I needed to know, our special characters are allowed, right, or whatever, because for some reason this isn't working. I typed the file name in the file name field, and it's not saving it. There must be some more information, except that that's not covered. And so people go, well, these are stupid instructions, and then they don't go back. Or if they do go back, they go back already frustrated before they open the instructions. Yeah. Why are we doing that?
And then they go and Google it for the answer that they're looking for, because they're not.
Or they call support, and now the company is incurring more cost because somebody has to call support to find out what are the valid characters for the file name field. That's the question that somebody is paying the customer support person to answer. And it's just, my head explodes. I think what we do is so valuable. I want every one of us out here who do this to be doing top-notch work. Top-notch work, because we can make such a difference when we're doing that. This goes right back to where I started with, I think what we do is important, and I think it matters, and I want every one of us to just be outstanding at what we do. Just, gah. All right, now I'm waving my arms, and gah. And the dog's looking at me like I've lost my mind. 70 pounds of Aussie just staring at me going, why is she doing, does that mean I'm going to get a cookie? Why is she doing that?
I would like a cookie right now.
I would like a cupcake right now, but that doesn't happen until later.
So are you seeing evidence of this error when you teach your new students? Do you see them writing type file name and file name field? Are you guiding them to that? Or is that something that they're doing naturally?
Interesting. I teach two different audiences. I teach my engineering students at the University of California, Riverside. About 8-9 years ago, I knew, because I'm still in touch with my professors, because I still live in town where I went to college. One of the professors who at that time had rotated into the department chair position, he called me and said, Sharon, we've got an interesting problem. And I said, yes, Tom, what is that interesting problem? He said, we're graduating engineers who cannot communicate. I said, really, Tom? Huh. Well, you're the only program in the country who's doing that. Everybody else is graduating engineers who communicate brilliantly. So I am co-teaching with Bonnie Graham, 72 students, three quarters a year. Yeah, 72. And it's a required class for all engineers. All engineers at my university. And we are now a top 10 engineering school, which is mind-blowing that I get to teach at a top 10 engineering school. This is just like...
Nice.
Yeah, it's like sprinkles on the cupcake, right? It's just the best. My engineering students, it never occurs to them to document the obvious. Now, we have to rein them in and help them understand that even if the only writing they ever do in their career is for other engineers don't know everything they know. And once that light goes on for them, then they're genius, right? They're just amazing. I also teach for the University of California Riverside Extension part of the house, and I teach there in the TechCom certificate program. So those are people who are transitioning into TechCom, because you know, for most of us, this is a second career. You transition into it. And sometimes I get people who are already doing it but would like to get some formal training. So I get both in the same classes. And that's a completely online program. For those people, I frequently have to push them that people know what the file name field is. But I start them all the way back at, let's develop personas. Who is it that we're talking to? Let's define our audience. Okay, given that we've defined our audience now, what information do they need? And, oh, here's a clue, I say in my online lectures. They don't need to know what the file name field is, unless it's special, unless there's something completely not obvious about it, and then, yeah, you're going to have to cover that. But if it's obvious, don't document it. Let's spend our time on things that are going to actually help people. And, you know, of course, all my students are brilliant. They're all above average. They're all, you know, more attractive than normal, you know, all of that. But to be very fair, most of my students are really excited about this field. And And they seem to get it. I mean, I don't know what they're doing once I cut them loose and they're, you know, out in the wild on their own. But most of them seem to get it. And most of them stay in touch. Cool. So hopefully they're out there doing excellent work. I want them to.
Well, that's why I was curious if these engineers had to take this required course and were down about it and saying, oh, I just got to take this to get my degree, or if they actually took to it and found an interest in it.
You know, what's really fun is we start every quarter, because as I said, I co-teach, so it's not the editorial we, it's me and Bonnie Graham together. We start the quarter by introducing ourselves and all that on the first day. And then we ask the room, show of hands, how many of you think this is just another stupid English class that the university has decided you have to take because you haven't paid enough for your sins? How many? And we'll typically get, out of 72 students, we'll get maybe 10 hands go up. And then we laugh and go, okay, so of the 10 of you who had the guts to do that, probably twice of you, you know, twice that number, are sitting there going, yeah, it's a stupid English class, right? And we go, right, we got it. It's not a stupid English class. This class is going to teach you how to communicate. And communicating with humans is what your products do. So we're not only going to teach you how to write appropriately in the business environment, we're going to teach you how to have your products communicate so that they are better and more easily used by humans. Better and more easily used by humans, all things being equal, do better in the marketplace. And that, we usually get their attention. And by the end of the quarter, we do a bunch of extra credit stuff for them, because writing is, you know, it's like, I had a math professor once who said, math is not a spectator sport, right? And he was right. Although I would have been perfectly happy to just watch people do math. I could watch them do math all day long. It's not my skill. I have other talents. Math is not one of them. But by the end of the quarter, we will very frequently get, as an extra credit assignment from a lot of students, that they initially thought this was going to be just another stupid writing class. And it turns out this may have been one of the most valuable classes in their engineering program, because they're being taught how to communicate in the business environment and what's important to communicate and how does one do that and how does that communication fit into the overall goals of the company they're working for, and how do their products communicate and why does that matter? It's not just another stupid writing program or stupid writing class, because it's not. We're committed to teaching. We want to be we view this as we are training the engineers to be the engineers that we want to work with. And we've been doing it long enough now, we could be working with some of the engineers that we've been, you know, because we've got quite a few of them out there now. And they're amazing. These guys are just, and guys here is gender neutral. These students are just, they're adorable. You know, they're 20, 21. We don't get them until they're juniors or seniors. It's a 5-year or 4-year program. Practically, it's a 5-year program. They're environmental engineers, chemical engineers, materials engineers, mechanical engineers, double E's, computer science, all kinds of engineers. And they are so excited about engineering. And they are convinced that there is no problem in this world that cannot be solved by suitably applying engineering to it. And it is such an honor to be able to teach these young people who are just so excited about the possibilities. I can't even begin. I usually wind up crying at the end of every quarter, because I do. It's hysterically funny and completely dorky. But they are just, they're brilliant and they're amazing and they're passionate and they're excited. And I don't mean one or two of them. Of the 72 of them, probably 60 of them are like that. And it's such an honor to be part of their education. It's like magic, you know? It's just like magic to be there in front of the room and contribute to their intellectual development. It's just the coolest thing ever.
That's awesome. That's awesome. That's cool.
I like doing it. You can tell. I like doing it.
That sounds like it. Even grading all those papers that you tweet about?
Oh, there are weekends where maybe I don't love them as much. Yeah, we tried having TAs for a while, but finding a TA who stands both in English and in engineering is tough. And so it's just easier if we do it ourselves. And I teach two labs, and my co-teacher teaches one. And so on any given weekend, I have 50 to 100 papers to grade.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah.
So that's why you're up with coffee every morning.
Well, I'm off this quarter, so I get to do what normal people do on the weekends, which almost always has me going, I don't know what to do with myself today. It's Saturday, and I have no giant pile of papers to grade. I don't know what to do with myself. So it's you know, I get the break. But, yeah, most weekends, 50 to 100 papers to grade, depending. And there are two weekends in a 10-week quarter where I have as many as 150 papers to grade. And that one, I grade until I start to lose the will to live. And that's usually at about 5 hours. I find myself looking at the next paper going, it's crap. I don't know. It's just crap. It's all crap. That's all I get from these students is crap. And they go, wait, maybe this is me. It is possible. I need a cupcake. And then I go back and look at the last paper I graded and I go, yeah, no, that wasn't crap. Actually, I think I'll adjust that score. Because the variable there was me. And that student actually did really well. So,
well, I am glad that we got to record this during your downtime. Timing worked out.
Yep, it worked out. It worked out.
Continuing on the education theme, your site says that you use your graduate studies in anthropology and technical communication. Can you share how they go together and how you've done that?
Well, when I was
Sure,
because I do everything briefly. When I was doing my graduate work, I did my graduate work with hammock vendors in southern Mexico. I have spent a lot of time in the Yucatan, which is the most real place I know of. And there's every time I say that, it's absolutely true to me. There's something about the subtropics in southern Mexico that is real, more real than anything I know. And as I was doing my field work, I spent a lot of time asking my hammock vendors why are you doing what you do? I'm always interested in why people do what they do because there's, you know, most of us have lots of options for doing what we do for a living, but we yet wind up doing something, right? And asking them about their hopes and dreams and do you want your children doing this? And, you know, just lots and lots and lots of questions. Well, there is a division of labor based on sex making hammocks. The women make hammocks. They weave them on these big frames, usually outside because they're big. And it's a really easy thing for women to do because it's highly interruptible. So you can do it around caretaking children and running a household and cooking and, you know, all of that. And then, so they make they weave the hammocks. And then the hammock vendors, they tie, it's called the arms of the hammock. They tie the arms on the hammock. And that requires a lot of strength in the hands. And so I'd spend a lot of time asking the men how they learned to do that and asking the women, how did you learn to weave a hammock? And just a lot of how did you learn that? And then watching and thinking about how they were doing. There's, for example, a theater to selling hammocks on the streets to tourists. There's a whole theater to it. So lots and lots of questions, lots of thinking about it, lots of analyzing it. This should sound familiar to those of us in TechCom. We spend our day asking questions about things. And if we are lucky enough to find users, you know, to find people who are using our products, watching them and asking, how do you know how to do that? And all, it's the same thing. It's the same thing. You know, I'm just not doing it in the subtropics now with tarantulas and, you know, other fun things. I get to do it, you know, where there's hot and cold running water and there's very rarely, you know, a tarantula the size of a dinner plate on my desk. And yeah, there really were tarantulas the size of dinner plates. Oh, yeah. They're called banana tarantulas, and they move faster than the wind, and they were not my favorite thing about my field work. I actually was happier with hepatitis and no running water than I was about the tarantulas. The tarantulas were tough.
That's a tough choice there.
I liked the wildlife in general, but the tarantulas were tough. They were just tough. That was really hard. And my 13-year-old kid who was with me for some of it really had a hard time with them. That was tough. The walking stick that was bigger than my shoe, that was easier to deal with than the tarantulas. But I like snakes. I think snakes are the bomb. Snakes are cool.
I don't do snakes.
They're totally cool. I don't like creepy, crawly, spidery things. I don't like them. But that's, you know, and now when I'm working with clients, I spend a great deal of time asking these same kinds of questions. I've been working with a client, and they had not in a long time sat down and really thought through their content creation, publishing, and management process. And so I spent the better part of a week just talking to everybody and asking questions, and how do you know that a new piece of content needs to be created? Does somebody tell you? Do you think about it? Okay, well, once you've created it, then what happens? Does it go to review? It does. Oh, well, tell me, who does it go to? Oh, okay, well, let me go talk to that person, you know? And okay, so when you get content for review, what do you do with that? How does that work? And we wound up in this, at the end of it, in this all-day meeting, where I took over all the whiteboards in this meeting room, and I mapped out the process from start to finish. And it was a surprise to them that it was as complicated as it turned out it was. And it wasn't the only reason I was there, but I realized very quickly that nobody knew how this worked. And once we got it all on the whiteboard, we were able to look at it, and they were able to say, "Dear God, no wonder we're struggling." And I said, "Yeah, I think we've got it in a nutshell. This is a very complicated workflow. Now let's look at what we can do to start simplifying this." You know, and it's not my job to tell my clients how to simplify it. It's my job to facilitate working through what simplified would be, because I've worked with many customers and many workflows, so I have some ideas for best practices, but my clients know what their business requirements and business drivers are. They may not know them like they can articulate them off the top of their head. That's part of my job, is to talk to them and see if I can get them to articulate them, and then we can figure it all out. But it's a real, and this is anthropology. This is ethnographic work. And this is what I've been, you know, I was trained to do this, right? I did it with hammock vendors, and now I do it in offices without tarantulas. But it's the same thing, and it's endlessly interesting, and it's really exciting to help clients figure out how to do things better and to articulate those things that maybe they didn't even know were business drivers. And are those drivers that they really wanted to have, or is that, you know, is that the old, "But we've always done it that way"? Well, maybe you have always done it that way, but is that how you consciously and deliberately wish to do it moving forward? You said do it short, Ed. That's as short as I can do it.
That's great. I think people don't realize, especially business people, that content is hard. I'm at a major financial firm now, and you know, we're going through literally every topic of a 10-year-old health system, and people are realizing that, you know, there's a lot to untangle and a lot of content and just a lot of work. And people, especially these people who are dealing with profit and loss in Excel all day, don't realize how hard content actually is, and organizing content and structuring it and making it available to users.
I'll never forget one time I was talking to a writer. This was a while back. I'm not even going to identify where I was. But he was certain that they needed to move to Ditta. And they didn't even know where all the source files were for all of their content. And they had buckets of content. That I knew, right? But they didn't even know where all the source files were. There was no inventory. They knew nothing. And so I said, okay, well, let's start by doing literally tracking down all the source files. Let's just figure out where those all are. And then we'll do an inventory. We'll figure out what we've got, etc. And he looked at me very seriously and he said, I don't understand why we just can't move to Ditta. I think all of the rest of this is a waste of time. And occasionally my mouth does things and I'm as surprised as anybody else in the room, right? I'm pretty good at not doing that, but occasionally it just happens. And I actually said out loud to the entire room, I said, what do you think? We're just going to go to the Ditta store and get a bucket of Ditta, maybe a big bucket, because I think we've got a lot of content. I mean, this is not, you can't just do that. You can, but you're not going to like it. There's going to be tarantulas everywhere. No. You know, you're not going to like it. It is often amazing to clients the effort that just figuring out something is what should be as simple as a content inventory. And I don't mean simple from our point of view, I mean simple from the bean counter's point of view. Well, let's just figure out what we've got. You know, well, we've got this, we've got that. You're going through the process, you know, it's not. Just trying to figure out the content you've got is, for a lot of companies, a major endeavor. And not because anybody's been bad. Yeah. It's just...
Well, because everyone always adds more and more and more, and there's never a chance to review and take away, which thankfully I have the luxury of doing now. But, you know, there's never, oh, let's have fewer help topics. Let's have more, and never that time and that chance to clear all the dead wood away.
And it's a technical debt, and I think we all are constantly running in that technical debt. I've never, ever talked to anybody in our field who said, oh, no, we were done with the content weeks before the product shipped, and we'd written everything we thought of, and, you know, no, we had all the videos we felt we needed and the quick starts. No, we just sat around for several weeks because we were tired. You know, nobody ever has that time. I mean, ever. Everybody's going like crazy trying to hit the deadlines, and you hit the deadlines knowing, you know what we really need? We need a whole bunch of industry-specific, vertical aligned 5-minute videos. That's what we need. Are we going to have the time to do it? No. Maybe we can do it before the next time we update this. But that's what we need. Or, I mean, you know, fill in the blank, right? There's always something, but everybody knows this. And it's, nobody has time to say, you know, let's just pull the whole department offline for 18 months. Let's go through, find all our source files, do a content inventory. Let's do some governance. You know, let's find out, is there content that we should retire? And nobody has that time. And it's frustrating because I think we all, to a certain extent, want to be able to do a better job gardening our content, if you will. But finding the time. Well, but that's why people bring me in to do that kind of stuff, because they realize that the worse it gets, the worse it's going to get, and it's got to get fixed.
I just have spent 18 months doing just that. And I know it's been luxurious. We had 4,000 help topics. A lot of them were redundant. We moved from RoboHelp into Ditta, and we're now going to be publishing to Confluence. But it was literally, we had the chance to go through all the topics, clean some up the dead wood. And sometimes it was just horrible, trying to unravel and trying to understand what someone was trying to say 10 years ago. But I know, and even though now I'm at the final stages of cleanup, I still see stuff that I missed or stuff that I wish I had time to go back and do. But it's been, like I said, it's been nice to have the luxury of time to go back and do this and clean up some of the stuff. And it's going to make it more useful to the user. It's going to make the content that's there easier to search and find the best results. And I know going forward, we're never going to get that chance again.
No, but how wonderful that your company realized that that needed to happen and that there's huge business benefits that come out of that. Just huge. Are you guys localizing? Do you translate at all?
We don't. No, thankfully we don't have to. Everything's online and just, you know, we're publishing no print and just online through Confluence.
A lot of times my clients, for reasons I don't understand, it just happens this way. Most of my clients don't localize. But I always want people, I always recommend that you pretend as though you're going to. Because if you pretend you're going to localize, you're probably going to write tighter. You're probably going to standardize on voice. You know, there's a whole bunch of benefits to pretending you're going to localize. And in my experience, the clients who say, and I'm not saying that you're going to do this, but I'll have clients who say, oh no, we'll never localize. And then somebody comes into their office and says, we just got this huge deal in Germany and we have to deliver the content in German. That won't be a problem, right? And this is the same company that has refused to do the kind of governance you just did. And now they discover that they've got the mess you had 18 months ago, and they're going to translate the whole thing into German, and they discover it's going to cost them an enormous amount of money. And then they call me and go, can you help us? We need to fix this in the next 30 days. I'm like,
you're right.
That's so cute. No, you're not going to fix that in 30 days. You know, let's come up with a real plan to do this. Because it's so cute, you think we could just fix this in 30 days. That's so cute.
Yeah. You want to try to take how many pages to German in 2 weeks? No problem.
It's just adorable you think that.
Oh, Lord.
Yeah, I'm good, but, you know, not that good.
Right, yeah. Good, fast, good, fast, quick. Pick two.
Good, fast, cheap.
No. That's it.
Pick and two. I actually think, I've thought about that recently. I don't think you can even get two. I don't think you can get good and cheap. I don't think you can do that. I don't think you can get cheap and good.
No, it's probably true.
I don't think you, I think it's pick one.
Being good takes time and that costs
exactly.
money.
Exactly. Anytime you, it, yeah. So I think pick one. And most companies, well, cheap. Oh, okay. You're going to discover the ROI in cheap is not what you were thinking. Cheap is way more expensive than you think. Isn't that Dolly Parton who said you'd be shocked at how expensive it is to look this cheap?
Yeah, I think you're right.
Yeah, I think it was. And that's true. That's absolutely the case.
Well, that segues to my next question. Your bio on TechCom Speakers Bureau has mentioned that you're interested in content as a business asset and what that means to a company and to our users. What does that mean to you?
I think that when I first started my career, we were still trying to convince anybody really in the company, we would have been happy with the janitor, that what we did was important to the overall success of the product. And there was lots of whining about, we need to be taken seriously, and you know, wah, wah. One of the things I'm delighted about now, at this point in my career, is the field has changed. And companies are starting to realize that content is not only important to the overall goals of the company, but, and this goes back to that customer experience, content is actually a good way to attract new customers, to keep those customers, and it's part of the bottom line. If you have crap content, as you discovered with the modem thing, the hotspot thing, if you have crap content, people don't do business with you. And companies are starting to realize that content is not something that the elves write in the dark of night. You know, you just put a plate of, I don't know, cookies and a ream of paper, and then you come in the morning and go, oh my God, it's been woven into gold. That's fabulous. That developing content and maintaining content and treating it like any other business asset costs money, and it takes time, and it's critical to the business. One of the things when September 11th happened and those towers went down, I remember thinking, we all thought many things, but this is how my brain works. Later, not immediately. I did not think this immediately. I'm not insane. But there was, what was it, Cantor Fitzgerald lost almost all the documents about how they did business. Think about that. If you lose all of this is how you do your business. If you lose that content, my God, how do you even start putting it together? I mean, Cantor Fitzgerald had many other problems, and this was the least of them. But later, you know, I was thinking about that. I was thinking, you know, this is the power of content. It tells you how to run your business. And if you lose that, that's huge. And the businesses are starting to, not every business, but they're the best of breed, are recognizing that content is something that has to be managed. It has to be treated like you do if you're in software and your source code. You wouldn't not back up your source code. You wouldn't let people just, you know, write source code however they felt like writing source code and checking it in or whatever as the whim occurs to them, you wouldn't do that.
And you wouldn't not QA it either.
It's code. It's fabulous. You know, my son is a computer programmer. We were talking not too long ago. He's in this wonderful company. He's got in on the ground floor. They love him. He loves them. They're all as happy as they could be. And the company is growing very quickly, and they're hiring QA people pretty fast. And he says that he loves everybody he works with in the company. They do this Friday afternoon lunch thing where they all go out and have lunch together, and that's kind of their staff meeting, and it's all good. And he says, you know, he sits next to the QA people, and he talks to them, and it's all good. Except when they're in the office and the QA person comes to him and says, "Hey, Matt, guess what? I broke your code." He says he just wants to, you know, just like speak to them in his dad voice, you know, "No, you didn't. Shut up. Go away." But he says he also realizes that he's not going to be able to think of all of the ways to break his code because his code makes sense to him. And our content is the same thing. We know what we meant to say, right? We know that. But somebody else has got to review it to make sure that we have done a good job of it. And it's not because we're bad writers or we're lazy writers or whatever. Somebody's got to do that, whether it's a peer review or technical review, whatever it is, somebody's got to do it. And companies are starting to realize that we need the review not because we're stupid or bad at what we do, but because you got to have it. You got to have another set of eyes.
Now, do you think it's because of this explosion of the web that people are finally valuing content, or do you think it's just the cost of doing business now?
I think it goes back to the customer experience. I think companies are realizing that most of their products are commodities or close enough to be commodities that they've got to find a way to differentiate themselves. Content marketing is huge now. Tell stories about your products. Be engaging about your products. Help people make a difference with their products. Okay, I'm going to tell you something I've told almost no one. Years ago, when I was in graduate school, I lived in student housing. We didn't have cable because we didn't have cable. Because it wasn't available in student housing, and even if it was, nobody had the money to get it, right? Because we were all, you know, busy starving to death. But, you know, there were some channels that you could get on the TV, you know, through the airwaves. Yes, children, once long ago, you could just get TV over the airwaves. It's crazy, but it's true. And I found this channel that sold things on TV. And you could... I know, everybody sees it now, right? But this was a brand new thing then. And I would watch this for hours. Being an anthropologist, I found this fascinating. And because what they did was really interesting. They were developing community. They would have people call in who had bought these items the last time they were for sale. And people would call in and talk about how wonderful the products were and how delighted they were. And so what they were doing is they were letting people have a chance to shine on TV, which is exciting. They were building demand by building community. And they were making these goods seem scarce and more valuable. This is all brilliant, right? This is brilliant positioning. And I've had friends who laughed at me, you know, because I can't believe she spends hours watching that. Yeah, I really did. Because there was all this stuff going on. And that's kind of what content marketing is trying to do now. And companies are realizing that by using content, written word, video, podcasts, all different ways of interacting with people who want to buy their product, you can position your product to be a scarce good, to be the product the cool kids are getting, to all of these things. And these things matter. These are competitive advantages and are going to improve the bottom line. And it's like the C-level woke up a couple of years ago and went, "Oh my God, content, we got to get some." And the rest of us, those of us in the content development field went, "Right, you got a bunch right over here. If we're going to move it to Ditto, we need a bigger bucket, you know, because we've got a lot, right? We're going to want to cover it all with the Ditto, so we're going to need a couple of gallons." But those of us who've been in the field for a while, we're like, right, it's right there. We've got it. We'd be happy to share it with you. We've been trying to do that for a long time. And yeah, it matters. And it's important. And it's critical. And yes, we will take that extra budget this year to make sure that we're doing a good job of it. Why, yes, yes, we will. Thank you.
So what's next?
What's next? What's next as in what?
What's next for Sharon Burton? Other than next semester.
Quarters. We're on the quarter system.
Okay.
What's next? I'm looking for my next interesting project, which is always fun. I'm looking to solve interesting problems. I'm talking to a place yet to be named about the possibility of pulling me in as salaried, which is interesting. I know. One of the reasons why I have almost always been independent is I like solving interesting problems, and the kinds of problems I like solving are not the kinds of problems that get solved often in companies. So I figured out a while back, I like coming into a company, helping them figure out how to solve the problem, solving the problem, and then once the problem is solved, I'm kind of done.
Okay.
Typically. Now, there are, you know, places where that's not necessarily true, but that's typically what I do. And the place I'm talking to, that's kind of what they do. They do consulting, and they go in and they do that, and then they go on to the next thing. And I have no idea if this is going to work out. That's why I'm not naming names or giving any more hints on that. But that would be, for me, a ton of fun, and I'm actually real interested in whether or not that works out. But regardless of whether that works out, looking for something new and interesting. I've been realizing that I need to teach myself Ditta, or Ditta is really hardcore. Ditta is the next place for me to go, I think. It's a lack in my toolkit. We all have a space in their toolkit that's not as strong as it could be. And that one's starting to bug me. So I think I'll be teaching myself Ditta next.
Yeah.
Well, you just get a bucket down at the Ditta store.
Yeah, they've got a small size, so you can start there.
I thought I'd get a pint, just, you know, like the easy, you know, just the easy part, and then, you know, later when I get, you know, good at it, I'll go get, you know, the giant gallon size.
I was very very fortunate early on to deal with the gallon bucket. I was involved very early on when Ditta came out in a conversion to structured authoring and did a lot of cleanup in X-Metal. And now we're coming back to it. I was very anti-Ditta for a long time, probably because I had to clean up so much XML, but came back to it, and now I'm glad that I did. So I think you should be able to pick it up pretty quickly.
Yeah, you know, I everything I do is right up to the edge of, and now we'll move it to Ditta. You know, I do structured authoring. I teach structured authoring. I help clients identify what topic types they've got. You know, what are their content types? You know, all of that stuff. It's just I've never actually, like, just tipped it right over into the Ditta. So I got FrameMaker. I figure I'll go into structured frame. I've read multiple books. I've got multiple books sitting here in my office. You know, Ditta 101 and blah, blah, blah. And I just need to sit down and go, okay, this week I shall push it into all the way. Because it's stupid at this point. And like you, I didn't like Ditta for the longest time. I thought it was overkill. I thought it was just dumb and stupid.
And expensive.
And needlessly expensive. But the last two or three years, watching this renaissance of content happen and realizing that content is not just TechCom, it's the entire enterprise, I'm changing my mind on that. I'm thinking that, you know what, I was at best misguided, if not actually completely wrong. And I think at an enterprise level, this may be the best way to solve this problem right now.
Nice. Yeah, I think Ditta has made a big comeback. I'm glad to be a part of it. So let's wrap up, Sharon. If people want to contact you, if they want to find you online, if they want to contact you about a gig, where's the best place to find you?
You can always go to my website, SharonBurton.com. Or you can just send me an email, sharon@sharonburton.com, or follow me on Twitter and you'll get lots of updates about coffee and content and my dog and gardening and the gym and content and things like that. Follow me on Twitter, Sharon Burton. I lack an imagination, so really, by and large, my name. It's easier.
It's just good marketing.
Well, you know, I'm also bad at names. I have a running joke that for the first year of my son's life, I had to keep his birth certificate right over his crib, you know, so I'd remember his name. And the same kind of goes for me. It's easier for me to remember if I just, you know, I'm on my third husband. Since my first husband, I've not changed my name. I figure it's just easier for me if I don't change my name. It's just that much easier. So there we are. So Sharon Burton.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for being our first guest on Content. It was better than I had ever anticipated. So thank you again for joining us. Thank you for getting up early and missing part of the beautiful day out in California.
Well, thank you. I'm super excited. This has been a ton of fun. Thank you so much.
Awesome. Once again, this is Content. My name is Ed Marsh. You can find me at edmarsh.com. Apparently, I'm not as creative as I thought either. I'm also at Twitter on Ed Marsh. And if you don't know about it, check out content.info. This is a site I created about a year ago that aggregates news about techcom and design and user experience and content strategy all in one place. There's about 35 different news feeds on there, and it gets refreshed daily, so go ahead and check it out.